You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 250, the Pastoral Epistles with Rick Brandon. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Can't complain.
Well, I can because I didn't make the fantasy playoffs, and you barely did. So congrats to you. I am now.
Yeah, I'm in. So the little 4 out of 5 loss, you know, four losing 4 out of the last 5, that hurt. So it dropped me, but I'm in.
Yeah, well, that's more than I can say for myself because it's been a rough year for me. But at least our listeners have not had to listen to too much fantasy talk this year. So maybe next year that'll change. All right, Mike. Well, we have a great interview today. What are we going to be talking about?
We're going to be talking with Rick Brandon, who's a friend of mine and a colleague at Logos, about the pastoral epistles. Well, it's great to have Rick on with us again. Rick Brandon, who is a co-laborer, colleague with me at Faith Life Corporation. Of course, that is the maker of Logos Bible software. Rick has been on the show before, but we have a lot of new listeners. And so, Rick, I want you to start by introducing yourself. Just tell us who you are, a little bit of background, what you do at Logos, you know, with the software or anything else you do there. And then kind of what your sweet spots are.
Okay, thanks, Mike. My name is Rick Brannon, and like Mike said, I do work at Faith Life, makers of Logos Bible software. And my responsibilities there involve managing the team that handles all of the original language data, so all the Hebrew, Greek, at all the different levels, so morphology and syntax and discourse and all of the reverse interlinear alignments that we produce. The team that I work on handles all of that data and makes sure it works well in the system. So in a nutshell, that's it. All of our Bible data sort of runs through our team. As far as me personally and my sweet spots, it's been probably, gosh, like 15 years ago where the pastoral epistles just jumped on my radar and haven't quite gotten off of it yet. So what the weird story there is, what happened was, is I really got involved in looking at the pastoral epistles. And that drove me into looking into other literature produced around the same time, before or after, other temporally cognate literature. So the Septuagint and the Apostolic Fathers specifically, and then also Philo and the works of Josephus and Greek pseudepigrapha and other classic works. So from the pastorals, I sort of got driven into this larger realm of literature, of early Christian literature. So where my sweet spot is now is kind of, let's say, pastoral epistles plus following literature. Mm-hmm. So what this all led to is I wrote a commentary on 1 Timothy that is called a lexical commentary on the pastoral epistles. The first volume is on 1 Timothy. That was published in 2016. And what that's all about really is one of the first things you need to do when you're exegeting a passage is you need to look at the words. That's not where you stop, but that is where you start. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I looked at the important vocabulary in 1 Timothy, and I looked at how it was used not only in the New Testament and not only in the Septuagint, but also in literature like the Apostolic Fathers and Josephus and Philo and stuff like that, to really understand what these terms would mean in the context of that time frame. Mm-hmm. And
we had either blogged or talked about on the podcast is something like that about the first volume. And what we can include, and we will include the first volume in our discussion today. But, you know, you've come out with a volume now on 2 Timothy. But before we jump into that, you know, people should know that, you know, these aren't just passing interests, you know, for you. You mentioned Apostolic Fathers and Septuagint.
Right.
You know, give us a little bit more, you know, specifically what you've done. Like what did you work on that Logos has for the Septuagint or the Apostolic Fathers? And I know you've actually published things on the Apostolic Fathers, so we want to mention that as well. But give us a, you know, more of a drill down.
Right. So for Logos, I did an interlinear of the Apostolic Fathers' writings in Greek. So 1 Clement, 2 Clement, the letters of Ignatius, the writings of Polycarp and the Martyrdom of Polycarp and a few other things like that. There's an interlinear that we put together that's available for Logos Bible software. But from there, I actually made a full translation into English of the Apostolic Fathers' writings, and that is available for Logos, but it's also published in print by Lexham Press. Mm-hmm. For the Septuagint, we did interlinears for the Septuagint for both the Rawls edition of the Septuagint and also the H.B. Sweet's edition of the Septuagint. And the Sweet edition, we actually turned into a translation as well. So we did further editorial work to turn that into a nice, readable English translation. That has not been published in print yet, but it is available for Logos Bible software. Mm-hmm. I also did work on Apocryphal Gospels, on the Greek Apocryphal Gospels, where I did translations of the major works available in Greek. So the Protevangelium of James, Infancy Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Peter, plus a lot of other fragmentary things that are actually really important for early Christianity, mm-hmm. fragments of papyrus and things, where they mention things or they record things about Jesus that is not attested to canonically. There's right. a great one about where Jesus is walking to the temple and he sees a priest go into the bath and out of the bath again, out of the mikveh, and there's a great discussion there about cleaning yourself with Jesus, right? So there's just all sorts of cool stuff going on in a lot of these fragments too. So I've been spent a lot of time there. Lexham Press has actually also published a print version of the Greek Apocryphal Gospels volume.
Yeah, for our audience, I mean, I get asked all the time, like, hey, you know, what's a good book on all that extra Jesus stuff? Okay, yeah. or can you recommend an English translation of the Septuagint? Now, again, if you're in the software world, and honestly, let's just be blunt, you ought to be. If you have Logos, you know, as a tool, again, we have our own English translation of the Septuagint, and it's very usable. Again, when you reverse interlinearize these things, it really, I think, deals effectively with the language barrier. You know, people should not presume that they have to, you know, have a degree in Greek, you know, to be able to use these sources and use them effectively. That's why we create what we create. But yeah, I'm asked all the time, you know, about, you know, resources and recommended books and whatnot. So I'm hoping you're paying attention if you're listening, because I don't ever want to get that question again.
Well, one of the cool things,
Mike, be my answer.
One of the cool things about that Septuagint translation, if you look at other English translations of the Septuagint, there are problems with the way that names in the Septuagint are rendered. They're typically just transliterated. And what that means is, if you know names from your study of the English translation of the Hebrew Bible, you can't follow the discussions in Greek because the names are different. So we actually did a lot of work to align the names where possible with actual forms that you would recognize if you only knew English translations of the Hebrew Bible.
So, yeah, and that you'd search for too.
Exactly. So that way you can actually read things like some genealogies or just regular stories and not have to have this filter of, now, who was that guy? Now, where was this again?
So I think people would be familiar with this just in terms of their English Bible. If you think about Noah in the New Testament, because you have this like alternate spelling, I can't remember what verse it is, but like N-O-E, and then you have N-O-A-H, you know, so some, you know, it, depending on what Bible you're using, if you're trying to search for, hey, where's Noah mentioned in the New Testament, you're not going to get everything because don't know the alternate spellings.
Right. And this comes out in the Septuagint because, if you're transliterating, then it's not Isaiah. It's probably something like Isaias. Ezekiel, you can probably track, but it's got CHs and looks kind of weird. Jeremiah gets even further out. And those are just the major names that you probably know already. Mm-hmm. When you get into some minor characters and the names are totally different, essentially, even though it's referring to the same person, you just can't track it. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the problems we wanted to solve with the English translation.
Yeah, so... lastly, again, one more thing I want to mention before we actually jump into the pastorals is you also have a book on Advent or for Advent. So say something about that.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. Probably 10 years ago, I was part of a church that was planted from another church. And the first year we were together, I wrote a really short Advent devotional based on the Revised Common Lectionary passages. And it's a really short question and answer type thing to where you're offered the passage. And then there are some very short questions about the passage. And then I gave you the answers too, because my context for using this was at the dinner table at home, and I wanted something as brain dead easy as possible. So that meant I had to include the answers, because I wasn't going to just have the question there and have to try to make it up, or not have something where I could lead my kids to help understand what the answer was. So that was great. We did it. And then Lexham Press heard that I had done that, and they were like, we kind of want to do an Advent devotional. So I filled out the rest of the cycle. The Revised Common Lectionary is a 3-year cycle of readings. Advent is the beginning of the church year, so it follows that particular cycle of readings. So we've really got 3 Advent devotionals in one that can be used with any year of the liturgical cycle, with the scripture passages and questions and answers for each day of the Advent season.
Yeah, I mean, we've used that. So I that just popped into my head too. I mean, and I'm glad it did, because, you know, this is the season for it. So exactly. If you're looking for something for Advent, either a little bit this year or subsequent years, I mean, that's one I would certainly recommend.
Thanks.
Well, let's jump into the pastorals here. You know, you've talked a little bit about what a lexical commentary is. You know, when you go to study a passage, basically the first thing that you're going to jump into, you know, is the words. Kind of goes without saying, but
right, you know, yeah. I mean, you read the passage, you kind of come to an understanding of it, but if you're going to dig into it a little bit, you kind of need to know what's going on there.
So, how do you sort of present that? Because there are going to be people in the audience that are familiar with things like Vine's Dictionary of New Testament Words, or, you know, other word study tools. So, what is this? Just describe what they're going to encounter with this.
Right. So, what we're going to encounter, the commentary is basically organized according to the passages. So if you were studying 1 Timothy 2 at the beginning, where it's talking about how all men are supposed to pray, you'd go to that verse and you would just look it up. And I discuss the passage as it exists, and I work through the words in the order in which they are, pretty much according to the English translation I use, which is the Lexham English Bible, which is a production of Faith Life. So I stop at each word that I determine is important. So not everything, but usually content-bearing words like nouns and verbs. And I identify the word in Greek. I also identify the other places where it occurs. I identify a few sort of prototypical usages. So I usually have a citation from somewhere else in the New Testament. I sort of like to work out from, like, let's say, Paul to the rest of the New Testament. And then I will, from there, look at extra sources. So if the word has a particularly appropriate usage in the Septuagint, I'll go and bring in that use of the word. And the real distinctive here is that if you go and look at an academic commentary of some sort, a lot of the references that I make, not all of them, but many of them, you would probably find in a footnote where they would say, oh yeah, go see, you know, Ezekiel 3 verse 47 or whatever, if that even exists. But what I actually do is I actually bring the text in translation right in the middle of the page. So there's this block quote where this thing that I say is relevant, I actually bring you in the text as well, so you can read this source that I'm talking about. So we don't just doom these citations to footnotes that nobody's ever going to look up. Right? We say, hey, this is important. It's important enough to mention, then it should be important enough to look at.
Yeah.
So I've done a lot of work sifting through all of those references, finding things that seem appropriate to the instance in the context we're in. So then from there, we would probably stretch out to some apostolic fathers or Josephus or Philo, or even some Greek pseudepigraphal stuff, if that's appropriate as well. But again, the distinction here is that I bring the use in context so that you can actually read a sentence or a couple of sentences where that word is used to get an idea of how it's used elsewhere, and let that filter into how you understand the text that you're working through in the New Testament.
Yeah, for a lot of people in this audience, of course, are going to be familiar at least with the phrase word studies. They're also going to have sort of taken a whack at doing word studies. And I hope, if that's you, and I know there's a lot of you out there, I hope you're paying attention, because what you just heard described is light years beyond Strong's tools. Okay. Getting usages in context where you don't have to, oh boy, I guess I got to go buy a translation of the pseudepigrapha to go look that up. Again, if you're not living in the software world, and even if you are, if you don't have those resources, there you go. You know, Rick's bringing it right to you, and he's in Paul. So he starts with Paul, wider New Testament, wider, you know, literature, and then actually showing you examples. To have that in one resource, is significant. And you already know that if you have taken a crack at doing word study. So, Rick, you wanted to jump in there.
I did, but I kind of forgot what I was going to say, Mike, to be honest. So.
Well, I just think because, you know, most people, when they sort of graduate beyond Bible reading, the next thing they do is I got to go get a concordance. I got to, you know, start doing word studies because I either hear about them or the pastor, mentions this and, what do the words mean, Greek and Hebrew, and sort of penetrate the English, which is all, obviously good. It's just something, we need to do. But, I know, again, because I know you, I'm familiar with the other volume, this is something that really not only gives you good data, but it presents it conveniently, again, where you don't have to just chase things.
Right. And in, almost in hindsight here, it's almost documentary of my journey in the sense that I started with the pastorals. I literally started with the pastorals, working through that text. Translating it, annotating it, looking at it in all sorts of different directions, reading just about everything I could find in commentaries that had been written about it. Mm-hmm. And then I got pulled into this extra literature because the thing about the pastorals we'll probably talk about in a little bit is that sometimes the vocabulary is a little bit wacky or it's a little bit it's different. There's a lot of single-use words in the pastorals. Mm-hmm. So then I was driven out into other sources to say, well, if this word is only used like two or three times in Paul or even the New Testament, well, why not look and see where it's used elsewhere and try to understand how it's used outside of the New Testament so they can better understand what's going on in the New Testament? So then I got driven into the Apostolic Fathers and I translated that and the Septuagint and we did a translation of that. And so and all of these things come back together in the lexical commentary volumes because they end up bringing back into English things that help you understand what's going on with the vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a sort of a segue to get us in, there are three things that I have, sitting here in front of myself that I want to be sure to get into you or get into with you in our time today. But again, when you start hearing things like, the pastoral epistles have a lot of vocabulary that only occurs once or twice, and then you're sort of, forced to look at other literature to get usage in context for that particular word or those words, that invariably raises certain questions. Because let's say that you find, well, this word was really used a lot at the end of the first century. Okay, so in a period, I'm just making this up here, but in a period sure. that post-dates the life of Paul. Now, when scholars run across stuff like that, that is one factor that would lead them to look at this particular portion of the pastoral epistle, we'll say, whichever one it might be. Mm-hmm. And they'll think thoughts like, well, I wonder if Paul really wrote this because of the vocabulary choices. You know, if it was somebody living 20 years or 30 years after Paul, this would sort of make sense because this word was kind of in vogue or it just shows up a lot. And so the vocabulary actually is one of the things that will lead scholars, again, to question, in this case, Pauline authorship. So you've spent a lot of time in the pastorals, and a lot of people in our audience are going to be familiar with the fact that Pauline authorship of the pastoral epistles is a hot debate. It's quite disputed. It's disputed in other regards, too. When we went through Colossians, we got into this because of the whole Gnostic mm-hmm. question. Mm-hmm. But the pastorals, again, sort of is a hotbed for this discussion. So can you explain to the people listening, why is Pauline authorship disputed for the pastoral epistles? Just give us a few instances, a few examples, a few sort of trajectories mm-hmm. That would help people understand this.
Well, there wasn't a whole lot of dispute about who wrote the pastorals until like the late 1700s, early 1800s, somewhere in there. My time frame, I don't remember it exactly, but Schleiermacher was probably the first guy to say, hey, there's a lot of vocabulary in the pastorals, a lot of these single-use words or hapax legomenon that exist in the pastorals. Like there's so many of them compared to other books that Paul wrote. So the thought there was, the pastoral epistles seem to use this vocabulary that isn't witnessed elsewhere in stuff that Paul wrote. So did Paul really write it? So that was one initial thought that goes back again to Schleiermacher, I think, was one of the first who sort of published on that back in the 1800s. From there, it was picked up by a guy named Harrison, Percy Neal Harrison, P.N. Harrison, who wrote a book called The Problem of the Pastoral Epistles. It was published in 1922, I think. And Harrison picked up on this, and he documented that the proportion of Hapax legomenon in the pastoral epistles was higher than the proportion in other Pauline epistles and in other New Testament books. So his argument was basically that if you look at word usage, that the pastorals are different, and one explanation of that might be that Paul didn't write it. Mm-hmm. Another thing that Harrison noted a few other things about it as well. One easy example would be in the pastorals, sometimes the same thing was said, but with different language. So Paul, in other epistles, talks about giving thanks, or I have thanks, right? He's giving thanks for something. That happens in all of his epistles, most of them, I'll say. But when that happens in the pastorals, it's said differently. It uses a phrase, karin echo, which is I have thanks, whereas outside of that, it would actually use a verb for giving thanks. Mm-hmm. So one of Harrison's points was, even things that should be the same in the pastorals are different. Why are they different? So scholars have sort of taken off from there to try to isolate differences between what happens in the pastorals and what happens in other Pauline epistles, and even take that to other Pauline epistles. Like you mentioned Colossians mm-hmm. and Ephesians. There's questions about which one was first, were they both written, or was one cribbed off of the other? I mean, it's just a big question that people have. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those same things happened with the pastorals. Another thing that people would look at would be instead of the number of single-use words or hapax legomenon that occur in a text, what words do they use all the time? And then mm-hmm. are those same words used all the time in other things that this guy supposedly wrote? So there's a lot of different axes of comparison on vocabulary that can be gone through. And Harrison sort of started down the road to that. The apex of that, I think, at least from my perspective, probably, let's say like the mid to late 90s, there was a book, I even forget what it's called, that Cambridge University Press published in their New Testament series that essentially argued that Pauline authorship of the pastoral epistles, it was semi-genuine in the sense that these are just a bunch of fragments that some, this is the extension of Harrison's argument, actually, that there was a dedicated Paulinist who had assembled some fragments from genuine Pauline material, and that those were the basis, which is a really huge form critical argument, that those were the basis for the pastorals. And this guy, well, Harrison thought that he isolated, I think, seven different fragments that were genuine Paul compared against the rest that was sort of expanded on. And this guy at Cambridge for his doctorate in like the late 90s, again, I forget the book, I can find that later, essentially took the fragmentary hypothesis to the apex, right? Like mm-hmm. every argument, you know, scholarship seems to go is I can one-up you, right? So this guy, this last guy sort of one-upped everybody else. And from there, it's kind of gone back downhill, I think. So that's really where it ends up, is people have this fragmentary hypothesis of the pastorals where there are areas of genuine Paul in there. Like, you know, there's like five verses here that had to have come from Paul because they use this great Pauline image and vocabulary. But the rest of this stuff, somebody who kind of knew Paul had to add it because it's not quite like Paul, is what they would mm-hmm. say. So
now, you know, most of this kind of stuff I deal with is, you know, Hebrew Bible side, and you're dealing with editors and redactors and whatnot. I mean, this is obviously similar. Mm-hmm. But one of the things, two things that I would imagine pop up in this is one objection. If somebody sort of is, you know, a little unnerved about, you know, questioning Paul's authorship on either the pastorals or something else, they would say, well, if Paul's writing about different subjects, doesn't that dictate different vocabulary? And you've already sort of addressed that by saying, well, even the stuff that is the same, you still get different vocabulary, but, right. but nevertheless, you know, different subject matter is going to call for different vocabulary, which is, you know, on its own, you know, just on the surface is kind of obvious, but it's not going to be like a silver bullet objection. And the other thing is the use of the amanuensis. Now we got into this in Colossians, and we actually also got into it in a Q&A where you know, I quoted, you know, some different scholars on this, and there's actually there's not just one method of dictation or being an amanuensis or using an amanuensis. There's like a spectrum of ways this could happen. So is this part of this discussion where somebody might say, instead of just a Paulinist, but like, hey, there was this amanuensis that Paul used, you know, we may not know his name, maybe we do, but he would have felt free knowing Paul and having worked for Paul and done this for Paul, with Paul in the room, so to speak, that maybe some of that is just his handiwork as well, because that was one of the modes of, you know, using, you know, an amanuensis of you know, producing a letter where you would tell your amanuensis, hey, this is what I want to say, and I'll, you know, take a whack at it and I'll look at it.
Right. Yeah. That kind of thing. That's totally why this isn't as simple as counting words and seeing what proportions are, because that's just not a way that you could actually measure style. There's a lot that would go into that. Even just measuring style is a huge question. But there are a few different axes, I guess, that we're talking about here. One is the words, but you mentioned one in that there are different topics in here. The other large difference is that the other epistles of Paul are letters to churches, and the pastoral epistles and Philemon are letters to individuals. So you have to ask, is there a register change? If I'm writing a letter to a church, is that going to be different than if I write a letter to my coworker, Timothy, who I've known for 10 years and has worked beside me and who I sent over to Ephesus? Now he's doing this stuff and I got to, you know, it's like,
yeah, he's going to be privy to some things that others are not. And
exactly.
What speak to him a little bit differently than you would, you know, somebody that you haven't spent 10 years with.
Right. What differences would that make in the narrative, in the text? The other, the amanuensis question is a really good one, because there's probably a strong case to be made, I think, that I'm not saying this is the way it happened, but Luke totally could have been the amanuensis for the pastoral epistles.
Yeah,
there are books written on that subject. It is not a far out speculation. That's actually something that's really realistic, because in the pastoral epistles, you run into more vocabulary that is in common with the Septuagint than the rest of the New Testament. You run into more vocabulary that is in common with Lucan material than the rest of the New Testament. I go on the other side of that equation is that, well, that's like Luke wrote half the New Testament, right? Between Luke and Acts, word count wise. So there's a lot to compare to there. But there's a lot of affinity between the way things are expressed in the pastoral epistles and the way they're expressed in Lucan material, and then also the reliance that both Luke and the pastorals have on Septuagint lexicography or Septuagint words. And then at the end of 2 Timothy, which is ostensibly the last letter, because if most people think the composition history of the pastorals would have gone 1 Timothy, Titus, 2 Timothy. There are some people who think differently, but that's probably the way it happened. So 2 Timothy was like the last one. And at the end of 2 Timothy, you have Paul asking for Luke to come back to him because he's useful. Right? Or no, Mark is useful and Luke is with him, I believe. So you have that as well, where Luke is placed in the room. So he has proximity, access, and he has a history with the man. So it very easily could have been Luke, as far as we're concerned looking at this. We don't know any different. So
it's reasonable.
It's reasonable. I'm not saying that that's exactly what happened, because we will never know. But as far as, you know, possible versus probable, Luke is both possible, but it could also be argued as probable as well.
Yeah, and for those, again, who are listening who might have missed the episode on Colossians, you know, the end of the letter, or the Q&A, the book that I quoted was by E. Randolph Richards called Paul and First Century Letter Writing. Subtitle is Secretaries, Composition, and Collection. So if anybody's really interested in this topic, that's a good thing to drill down on.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree on Randolph Richards, because he has the scholarly book, his dissertation, which was published, and then also the Tyndale House, which published, I think, is the one you're talking about, which is a really great look at who the amanuenses are, what they did, how they operated, and how plausible it is that Paul could have used one of these people. So
uses lots of classical examples too. I mean, he's not just, again, he's not making stuff up. He's drawing on the literary world, you know, of letter writing. So it's an informed discussion and really quite detailed, to be honest. Now, there's one other issue that you're kind of into that I want to, you know, hit on, or at least let you introduce people to before we get into 2 Timothy. and the two things I want to talk about there, and that is stylometry. So that's probably a term that a lot of our listeners have not heard of. So can you tell us what it is and how it might relate, how it does relate in some way to authorship, specifically the pastorals and that whole debate?
So stylometry would be a term that people would use as a way to describe how to measure style, if style is a thing that can be measured. So the classic book here is one that was published, I think, in the early 80s by a guy called Anthony Kenny. The book is called A Stylometric Study of the New Testament. You'll probably never find one anywhere because they're hard to come by. And if you do find one, it's going to be $100.
Right, one of those.
one of those. We all have lists of books like that, right, Mike? Anyway, it's a slim little volume, but what he does for the first time, why Kenny is notable, is it's the first thing that is a stylometric study that actually uses an analyzed text. So Kenny's textual basis is the 1979 era version of the Freeburg morphology of the Greek New Testament. What that means is every word of the Greek New Testament has been analyzed grammatically for part of speech and other sort of formal morphological form criteria, as well as lexical form. What that means is Kenny's study, he has isolated 99 things that he tests for. And the way he works is he says, you have these questions, and they're like yes or no questions that you ask of every word in the New Testament. And then you track all those answers and derive statistics from them. These yes or no questions are things like, is the word a verb? Yes or no, it either is or it isn't. Is the word kai, which is a very common connective, a conjunction in Greek, or is the word in the perfect tense? So there are all these questions based on the grammar or the word form that he can ask, that he did ask.
And then he's looking for patterns,
and he ends up tracking them in like a 50-word window so he can see things going up and down across the text and what the associations are. So the other impressive thing about this, Mike, is Kenny hand-counted it because his only source for Freeburg was microfiche.
Okay. Oh my goodness.
So he hand-counted, he went through every word in the Greek New Testament, and he hand-tallied answers to all of these questions for every word. And then he did all of the math, I don't know, by longhand. I mean, this was 1981, 82, so he probably had calculators, obviously.
Was this like a prison sentence?
it sounds about like, what, the third or fourth level of Dante, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty horrible. But anyway, so this is the work the man did, and it's incredible. But he specifically applied this. He has a few cases in his book where he sort of applies the data to come up with an answer or something. And one of the reasons why Kenny is so well respected is that he doesn't make any wild accusations or wild claims. He's very reasoned and very cautious and he just approaches it well.
Yeah, so, I mean, just think of when I say he's looking for patterns. Okay, whether we realize it or not, when we write, we fall into patterns. They just become unconscious. You know, we'll tend to use a particular phrase and either never vary from it or only vary from it in a specific context. You know, Greek is an inflected language, which means, you know, its verbs and nouns will be affected by, you know, adding endings and sometimes prefixes and whatnot. So a guy like Kenny would look for, okay, you know, here we have this particular verb. It's in this particular grammatical form. It has this person and number. It's interesting that Paul does, you know, uses this 20 times in this form, you know, or something like that. So he's looking for where the patterns are, you know, like where does the writer place conjunctions? Because in Greek, that's variable. Greek word order is not like English word order. You know, where are words placed? Which kind of words are used? Which, you know, vocabulary words? What's the grammatical form? All these things to a native Greek writer would be sort of unconscious. It's just the way he would do it without even thinking about it. And so somebody like Kenny, looking after the fact, is looking to detect. I mean, we would do this with computers now.
Right.
You know, which is what makes his work just kind of crazy. But he's looking for patterns and where patterns break.
Right. And you know, they're, that sort they're, of thing. there are patterns, and even more than patterns, it's more like they're trends, mm-hmm. right? It's not like he's establishing rules. Now, if Paul wrote this, then he's going to use this word two times and this form five times. And it's even less than that because he wants to develop a distribution of use throughout the text. Mm-hmm. So he actually does some serious statistical work to tie all of these counts into something meaningful. So when he throws his data at the pastoral epistles, that particular problem, what he does is he compares the way that his 99 features, he calls them, work out across the pastorals and compares them to the so-called undisputed Paulines, let's say, although they're not all undisputed at this point in time. Mm-hmm. So what he finds essentially is that these are his findings. He basically says that Titus is, if any of them is going to be rejected, it's probably Titus, if you look at his criteria. Strangely enough, he says that one is kind of an outlier, but even in the sense of it being an outlier, it's like really close. It's just the other Paulines, the other 12 are bundled just a little bit closer, and this Titus is sort of on the outside. So even him saying it's on the outside doesn't mean he doesn't think it's Pauline. It mm-hmm. just means that of the group, that's the one that trends out.
Right. That one's a little less Pauline than the other ones.
Well, exactly. And that's the thing that's the problem with a lot of these studies that Kenny doesn't necessarily fall into is that, hey, I'm going to test all the Paulines. Hey, look, the pastorals ended up all like in this ball kind of outside. But, you know, if your ball is 100 and all of Paul's stuff is in like the 90s and like, you know, your pastorals are like 97, it's like, is that really outside or is that still to get? I mean, what? Even if it's different, does different mean that he didn't author it? Is it different enough?
Who determines how much of a difference matters for drawing some sort of conclusion?
Exactly. So Kenny doesn't fall into that trap. And the other interesting thing that Kenny says is that 2 Timothy, which is one that people routinely discount as not Pauline, he says, according to his criteria, it's as Pauline as 2 Corinthians.
That's 180 degrees.
So even though it uses words that aren't the same and there might be some different conjunctions or whatever, as far as looking at this whole complex of features that he's put together based on the analysis that he was using, he says the distributions are such that, I mean, they're basically, he says, let me see here, it's as near the center of the constellation as 2 Corinthians. So, wow. And most people don't have a problem with 2 Corinthians. So as far as stylometry, that's kind of where Kenny lies on the pastorals anyway.
I think that gives people enough exposure to, you know, this is the kind of work that academics do. Now, of course, back in Kenny's day, they're doing it by hand, but now they can put these analyzed texts, you know, that have all the grammatical information, you know, applied to each word, you know, into computers, and then computers, you know, would look for this kind of information. You know, like you could put Kenny's criteria in there and the computer would produce, you know, the patterning or not, you know, that he was looking for. You know, it's like data management in some other field. This is the kind of thing that scholars will be doing, you know, at least not all of them. You know, some Greek scholars and New Testament scholars, they're not going to have any time for this or really any interest, but there are people, you know, out there that are doing this kind of work. So I think it's just useful that people know that.
And I think the other thing to mention about Kenny is that he was not a New Testament guy. He was a classicist. Mm. So it's not like he was going to the New Testament to try to prove something on his own. I don't even know if the man's a believer or not, I don't even know if he's alive, but he was, I mean, all of his published work is not religious studies, is not New Testament. So he was just looking at stylometry, and I guess he came across an analyzed text and figured he'd go to town on it.
Sure. Yeah, why not?
But I guess my point is he wasn't coming to the text, I don't think, with a dog in the fight. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So yeah. Well, and that's important too. Well, let's talk about 2 Timothy, your second lexical commentary here. And as we chatted a couple of weeks ago, you know, when I saw, you know, the announcement on Twitter, you know, come out that this was ready, and I saw a few other things, and there were two things that caught my eye. So I'm gonna ask these together.
Sure.
There was a comment about the presence of charge language, essentially commands, mm-hmm. where Paul, you know, commands Timothy in the presence of either God, you know, deity figure or angels and other sorts of stuff. So that drew my eye naturally. And then there was this notion, or I shouldn't say notion, this possibility, this other sort of theory, maybe we can call it a theory. You can use a better word if there is one, that 2 Timothy was not Paul's last will and testament, because that's basically what you see all the time.
Right.
So can you jump into both of those things? Because I'm sure you discuss these in the lexical commentary, but just what's going on here?
Yeah. So like,
what's charge language? Let's just start there.
Start there. Charge language. Okay. So this is something I picked up from a guy called Craig Smith. Mm-hmm. And his dissertation actually was published in 2006 by Sheffield Phoenix Press. It's called Timothy's Task, Paul's Prospect, A New Reading of 2 Timothy. So his dissertation basically combined both of these elements that we're talking about here. Number one, talking about what is a charge, and he's looking more in the formal sense of a charge. There are sort of two ways to define things. One would be like semantically, or what's he really trying to say? And the other would be, are there formal criteria that he's using that show that this is what he's trying to accomplish? Mm-hmm. So an example from the charge of a charge that's not in 2 Timothy, but in 1 Timothy, in 1 Timothy 5:21, and this is a doozy, it says, I testify solemnly before God and Christ Jesus and the elect angels that you observe these things without prejudice, doing nothing according to partiality. And then he goes on and says, don't put hands on anyone hastily and don't participate in the sins of others. Keep yourself pure. And he goes on, right? This is 1 Timothy 5. Mm-hmm. So what a charge is, there's basically four different elements, formal elements in a charge. And one would be the charge verb. In this case of 1 Timothy 5:21, it's I testify solemnly. The Greek word is diamartureo, or diamarturomai is actually the word in the text, testify solemnly. So that's the first thing. There's a particular charge verb, and he's isolated a list of things that tends to be. It might also be like a semantic range or like a Leonidas semantic domain type thing. You could probably tie it that way as well. There are people who are charged. So he says, I charge you to do this kind of thing, or I charge these people to do that, right? Mm-hmm. There's an authority phrase, and that's where we talk about before God and Christ Jesus and the elect angels. So like in 1 Timothy 5:21, he's bringing out all the big guns. This isn't just Paul, because I mean, Paul starts out the letter, hey, I'm an apostle. I'm writing this to you. I'm thinking that's enough, right? But for whatever reason here, he's saying, he's not just saying it on his own authority. He's appealing to a much higher authority as witnesses to him doing this thing. So he's not just saying, I'm telling you to do it. He's saying, I'm telling you to do it, and these guys are watching, and you need to make sure that you're going to do this because I'm invoking these people, these authorities as I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. So after that, there's the content of the charge. So what are you telling me to do? So I testify solemnly. You need to do this before God and the angels and Christ Jesus and everybody else. Here's what has to be done. So there are those four common elements. There's sometimes a fifth element, which has more to do with the implications of what the charge is. And we get into that, I think, more in 2 Timothy, because the reason why this is important in 2 Timothy is because the part in 2 Timothy that most people say is like Paul's last will and testament, which is 2 Timothy chapter 4, like 1 through 8. What this guy Smith says is that's not a will and testament. It doesn't adhere to the formal qualities, the formal definition of a will and testament. He also goes through that in his book. What are the formal things that make up a will and testament, or a sort of a testamentary piece of literature here? And he says 2 Timothy doesn't really fit that. So because of the way 2 Timothy is structured and the content of it, people say, oh, well, Paul must be about ready to die and he must be, you know, passing his ministry on to Timothy. He says, verse 6 of chapter 4, I'm already being poured out as a drink offering. My departure is near. I fought the good fight. I'm done. So people say, oh, my goodness, Paul must be getting ready to die. The crown of righteousness is reserved for me. Like all of this stuff, which we look at today and we say, wow, Paul's getting ready to just kind of die here. Smith goes through and he shows how a lot of that stuff, we today read it that way because that's how we've sort of been trained to read it, not necessarily because that's what it's saying. And he gets there by saying, this is a charge, because it's a charge literature. So we have to look at it through that form, through that way that it's put together.
Yeah, that's interesting that it, you know, the whole last will and testament thing, that it doesn't actually conform, you know, to the way those things are done, because, you know, I mean, scholars have looked at lots of things Paul does where he does conform to, you know, literary conventions, you know, in other areas. So that's kind of striking. I mean, I've never heard that before. What do you think of that? I mean, what's your take?
I suppose my basic take is that, I mean, I think Smith is probably right. I mean, I might be a little bit starstruck by his argument. I don't know, but it seems pretty solid to me, because he goes through most of those things where we would read them and say, wow, that must mean Paul's ready to die, or he's just about ready to take, or he's ready to hand this over to Timothy, because that's sort of the way we've been conditioned to read it. Mm-hmm. And Smith walks through each one of those pieces and shows how there's an alternate and possibly better explanation about how, at the word level, which is the important part for the commentary that I picked up, at the word level, like, for instance, being poured out as a drink offering, the time of my departure is imminent, that kind of stuff does not have to refer to death. Mm-hmm. It refers to a drink offering being made, and time of my departure is more of language of release. Like, there's a spot in Philo which uses the same exact language, only it's talking about a governor giving up his term and moving on to something else. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the thought from Smith is that at this point in first and second Timothy, Paul pretty much knows he's getting released from prison. So Paul isn't saying, yo, dude, I'm getting out of prison, take my ministry and go. If Paul was going to do that, he probably would have done it already. What Paul is saying is he's getting energized because he knows he's got more work to do. And he's saying to Timothy, you need to go back, you need to go do your work and do it as excitedly and as, I'm running out of words here, in the same way that I'm going to go do it. He says, I'm already poured out. I'm going to do this. I fought this fight and I'm going to do it. This crown of righteousness I'm going to get. And he'll award it to me on that day, but he's not like ready for that day to happen yet. Paul's got more work to do and he's excited about it. He's saying to Timothy, you need to go out and do the work that you're charged with too. Not, you need to go out and finish my job. He's like, Timothy, you got to go out and do your own job and go do your own thing.
Hmm. That's really interesting. What do you, I mean, what have you come across as far as commentaries about, and I'm sure you discussed this because it's, you know, you're dealing with vocabulary, the elect angels phrase.
Yeah, I would have to look back at my first Timothy stuff. And I actually wrote an article in Bible Study Magazine about that phrase, about that charge on the pastoral epistles issue, Mike. Mm-hmm. What do I think about it? I would have to remember. I'm sure you run into it sometimes too, but it's like you write things down and you know you can go look at them, but I just don't have the book with me to go back and look at it right now.
Well, the stuff that I've looked at, you know, and I did this, you know, for the angels book, is there are a number of scholars that take the phrase elect angels and they sort of say it's a way of referring to loyal members of the heavenly host, you know, in order to deliberately contrast them with fallen, you know, angels. Okay. That sort of thing.
Right. So I just looked up, because I've got this Logos software, and my first Timothy commentary is actually inside Logos as well.
There you go. And so did you do anything with that?
Well, yeah. So that's the third witness in the charge. Strangely, the Apocalypse of Moses uses the same phrase. The context is, and I'm reading this straight from the commentary, this is why it's so cool. Then Eve rose and went out and fell on the ground and said, I have sinned, O God, I have sinned, O Father of all, I have sinned against you, I have sinned against your chosen angels, I have sinned against the cherubim, I have sinned against your steadfast throne, I have sinned, O Lord, I have sinned much, I have sinned before. I guess there was some sin going on. This is at Eve's repentance, I guess. And all sin in creation has come about through me. So she's using the term elect angels. This is like almost a laundry list of divine beings that Eve has offended and sinned against, and it's included in there. So that was sort of the key that I had going out there as far as how it is used elsewhere, is that when Eve is repenting and she's saying that she has sinned and she's confessing this to the higher beings, she includes chosen angels in that.
Yeah, I mean, my take on this kind of thing is that, you know, I think it's generally reasonable in the New Testament context to look at this as, okay, elect angels are the ones who are loyal to God. Okay, I get that. But, you know, in view of that example, what What that says to me, and there's a reference in 1st Enoch 31 or 39:1 that describes, you know, the angels, you know, as elect angels, and then they it's sort of a forward look that some of these elect angels are going to go down and, you know, sin on the earth. Okay, so, you know, the bigger picture to me is order. Mm-hmm. In other words, Eve is violating the order that God wants, and he includes, you know, and she includes, you know, the angels in that discussion or in that context, because they are charged with keeping things in order the way God wants, you know, in their realm. And then God has also, you know, created human imagers to order things here the way he wants. So when we sin against God, we violate the way that God wants things, you know, mm-hmm. the good order that God wants to be perpetuated and to be ongoing. So to me, that's not too far afield, you know, for a writer, you know, to put this in the mouth of Eve and include them. It's not that they're sovereign, but they are part of God's good order. And this is a violation. This is an aberration, an anomaly.
Right. And there's actually, I look back because there's a spot in 1 Timothy 3:16 where it talks about the angels being witnesses. Mm-hmm. Right. And that hymnic section at the end of 1 Timothy 3. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went into, there's a spot in Testament of Levi 19, where it says, basically, their father said to them, the Lord is my witness, and his angels are my witnesses, and you are my witnesses, and I am witness concerning the word from your mouth. So there, so we sort of have that delineation of roles again that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And then Josephus uses something similar in Wars, Josephus Wars 2:401. He says, I call witness to your sanctuary and the holy angels of God and this country common to us all that I have not kept back anything that is for your preservation. So Josephus' typical role there is trying to cover his own behind, I guess.
Yeah, but he does that on occasion.
My gosh. Talk about revisionist history sometimes, right? It's a long trend. But anyway, in that case, he's also calling the angels of God as witnesses. That you might even be able to call that a charge there in Josephus because it has some of the same elements. But he's calling in the angels of God as a witness to what he's doing. So,
yeah, and that has Old Testament roots. I mean, I didn't, you know, it was a little far afield for what I was doing in the New Testament section of my angels book because I don't know that you can really say that this is in the mind of the New Testament writer, because in the Old Testament, this is always covenantal context. So in some of these instances, I don't know that we can really, you know, tie it in with that. But you'd get in the ancient Near East, you know, when treaties were made, you know, and somebody would write up a formal treaty, you would call the gods, you know, you'd call the pantheon, mm-hmm. the council to bear witness to what was going on. Sometimes they'd actually list the names. Sometimes it would be a generic reference. And the whole idea is that if either you or I violate this, you know, covenant, well, the gods are going to kick our butts now, you know, because they're watching, you know, and they're approving of this. So if we violate it, we're in big trouble, not just with each other, but with them. And so there might be something like that, you know, going on again, but that's just part of the bigger motif of order, to the way God wants things.
Right.
As opposed to chaos. You know, God doesn't want things chaotic. He wants things done as he created them to do, you know, to function. So, yeah, I'm not, the language isn't that surprising. It's just, you know, we don't really think angelologically enough, you know, typically to sort of have a category for that. Mm-hmm. But again, it's really not that, you know, out in left field, at least, you know, to my ear. But, you know, I spent a lot of time, you know, thinking about that kind of stuff. So that's really interesting. You know, both of those elements, you know, because it's easy to read over when Paul is, you know, charging Timothy or commanding, you know, somebody, it's easy to read over the fact that on a couple of occasions, you know, the heavenly host is included right. in that. Very easy to read over that. So I'm glad we mentioned that. And then if Smith's work is correct, what's the title of his book again? Because we ought to post that as well.
Yeah, the title is Timothy's Task, Paul's Prospect.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, if he goes through this element by element and really finds, you know, some serious gaps or outliers, you know, with the normal Testament language, I mean, that that really would call for us to rethink, you know, what's going on there. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, basically, according to his own testimony in the book, in his conclusion, he says he compared the structure of testaments and farewell speeches, including the last words and deathbed speeches in rabbinic literature, with 2 Timothy 4:1-8. And it was readily apparent that on structural grounds, 2 Timothy 4:1-8 didn't really fit any of those models, didn't fit any of those forms. It didn't have the correct formal elements.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this has been good. Again, to wrap up, you know, I want to, again, alert listeners. You know, I don't just bring on people who, you know, have come out with something new and it's like, oh, well, let's try to sell copies of that and whatnot. I mean, I hope you do buy the book. I mean, when I do have somebody on, you know, it's because there's something about their work that I think is really beneficial to this audience. And what I want you to notice here is all discussions, let's not even use the word commentary, but all discussions of biblical material are not the same. I mean, in Rick's case, Rick has his head in a lot of nuts and bolts kind of stuff, but he's making an effort. This is our consistent pattern here on the Naked Bible podcast. I look for people who are doing serious work in the text and then trying to produce something that helps the non-specialist benefit from their work. It's a simple formula, and this is one of those. I mean, a lot of this stuff is kind of heady scholarship, but I don't think there's anything here in this episode of the podcast that people who are interested in Paul, interested in issues of authorship, interested in the pastoral epistles, and at the end they're even interested in angelology, okay? I mean, this is a discussion you can follow, and these are tools that you can use. So if you want something that's cutting edge, is really based on primary text, nuts and bolts kind of stuff that you can root what you're saying and thinking about in relation to Bible study in the actual text, this is the kind of stuff you should have.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, Mike. I hope our audiences enjoy these types of episodes. It's fun bringing scholars on, seeing how you're using the tools, what kind of stuff you're digging up. I think it's a prime example of what we're trying to do here at the Naked Bible Podcast.
Yeah. Every once in a while, we want people to know that tools are out there so that they can use them. And, you know, in my case, pastoral epistles isn't a big interest of mine. So, you know, I'm probably not going to wind up there doing a book study. So it's nice to have Rick on to talk about it, because he just loves them. You know, he's just been into it for years.
And next week, Mike, we're going to have Dr. Allert on. What are we going to be talking about with him?
Oh, yeah. Dr. Allert, Craig Allert, has a book on patristic, you know, early church interpretation of Genesis, Genesis 1, specifically creation. So that's going to be really interesting, because the church fathers, the patristic fathers, are often used as ammunition to justify one approach to the creation story in Genesis 1 over another. So they get used, again, sort of to beat somebody's opponent over the head quite frequently. And Craig's book is really going to talk about, you know, not only is that really fair, is that really wise, but the sort of the diversity of opinion in the fathers about how Genesis, you know, should be interpreted and of course was interpreted by them. So I think it's going to be an interesting episode, because we don't do a whole lot of church history on the podcast. But in this case, because it's Genesis, I thought it was really worth doing, because it is going to take us into this whole issue that we do talk about in the podcast about sort of being a slave to literal interpretation and like what is that? So believers, really smart people, have not only struggled, you know, with what to do with Genesis, you know, for millennia, but they also were quite willing to move beyond a simplistic literalistic approach, you know, to those early chapters.
All right. Looking forward to that one, as always. So just want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.